So as I said, the goal of this project is to collect history, and there are many books that have been published about Patuxent Village history, and I know many of you are familiar with them. I brought some of the ones that I have here. I'll start off with this one. This is Second Nature. This was done by Janet Hartman. I think it's one of our more recent histories of Patuxent Village that was published, if I'm correct. I think it came out 3 years ago, Janet? 3 or 4 years?
No,
5 years ago. And then Hazel Wade Kennedy. Many of you may have known her if you lived in Patuxent. Fragments of Time. She wrote this one. Bird's Eye View of Edgewood. Now remember, Patuxent does include Cranston. This one by Don D'Amato. It's Warwick, but many of the photos in there are, there's a section on Patuxent Village. And then this one is the same series, and it's about Patuxent. And I know that there's some faces in here that are familiar to all of you. I know Henry, there's a wonderful picture of you here when you were much younger. And many of the photographs that are in both of these books and possibly in many of these others belong to Henry Brown. Henry Brown, I assume many of you know him, but he is a long-lived resident of Patuxent Village, and he has a wonderful collection of his family papers in his home. And he has divided them into many sections of Warwick, and his Patuxent Village collection is very extensive. It includes original family letters, papers, photographs, many different things that he just felt that were very important to keep. And I believe he also still visits places where they sell old books and objects to collect some images of Warwick. So what we're trying to do is build on the collection and also to find out what else is out there in your homes, in your attics, in your private papers, photographs, objects. There's someone who would have liked to be here tonight, Ed Greer, who collects many items of Patuxent Village. He has an extensive collection of bottles from the old coal farm. And he would have loved to be here, but he had a family. He had to go out of town to visit family, but he wanted to bring some of the bottles and tell stories behind them, because not only does he collect the bottles, but he does research and finds out more about what was going on at that time, and he has stories to share. It's interesting to hear stories behind bottles, but he does have them. So those are the kinds of things we're trying to discover. If you did not know that we were looking for objects, photographs, or anything that you can share with us, that's what we'd like to do. This is the beginning of what we hope to call a series of story circles. Tonight we're going to try to engage you. That's why we're in a circle here. We want to make you part of this lecture. I'm not going to do all the talking. You're going to do much of the talking if I can get you started. We're going to find part of the reason why I was asking for objects is to have somebody hold something up and then have us all share stories of that particular, what that means to you, and as a resident of Patuxent Village, as someone who moved in like I did, much older. So keep that in mind. As we go through tonight, I will pick out a few themes, and we will try to convene again, not necessarily at the library, but maybe we can start making these circles in our own private homes. If you want to host one in your home, we could do it somewhere in Patuxent. So we'd like to do more of this. Again, we're trying to collect history, stories, not just objects, but your stories, oral history. I find that that's very important. There's much that's published in our history books, and I think memories and oral histories are just so important because it really gives life into the history, living history of a place or an object, as I said. One of the things that I found tonight that I would like to start with, that Rosetta, how do you say your last name?
DeRozier?
DeRozier, excuse me. Mrs. DeRozier's brought some old yearbooks. These are Aldridge High School. And I have a son who's at Aldridge Junior High, so I don't know what it was like to be here.
High at that time.
It was a senior high. and they're fascinating. And aside from looking through them and seeing some of the photographs, I went to the back and saw some of the businesses that were around at the time. And I'd like to just name a few and see if they spark any memories. If anybody wants to jump in and talk about anything, please feel free. As I said, this is for you. I would like for you all to speak. Henry Brown here, I've invited him. He's brought some objects, too, that he's going to talk about. But again, I'd like to engage you in this discussion, in this conversation. And then it's interesting to see that some of these places are still in business. Now, this yearbook is 1940, Aldridge Senior High. And the mayor at the time was Albert
Rurot.
Albert Rurot. And he bought an ad here. There's a place called Maurice Smith Incorporated Typewriters. That's from Providence. Some of these obviously were not Warwick businesses. So there was a typewriter business.
I think he lived in Warwick
at one time. Okay, Mr. Smith. Did he live in Patuxent?
I'm not sure.
Cole and Son, there's that Cole Farm. Cole and Son Dairies bought an ad. It's a very small one. I don't know what they cost, but it's one of the smaller ones. And the telephone is interesting, too. It's Hopkinton, 9530. Hopkins, yes, 9530. Okay, there's Babcock Super Service. Babcock Super Service, gas, oil, and grease.
Where was he located?
1343 Broad Street. It's in Edgewood. Yeah. Remington Funeral Home, Broad Street. Aero Systems, that doesn't have, they made baseball masks, baseball bases, hockey shin guards. And then there's an ad for sale, a dog, eats everything and likes children. That's great. And then we have a representative, Joseph Mills. He was a representative, state rep.
He became mayor.
When did he, so he was rep in 1940. And when did he become mayor? In the 50s. So he served in the House of Representatives for 10 years and then became mayor of Warwick? Okay. Who attended Aldridge? High school.
Junior.
High school. How about junior high? When did it become a junior high? See, I'm learning.
In
58.
Was the high school 4 years or 9th through 12th?
From 7th to 12th grade?
We were the first class to start in the 7th and go right through the graduated.
This particular class here?
1941.
1941 went from 7th through 12th.
Patuxent School.
The Patuxent School.
Yeah.
So you went from the Patuxent School to Aldridge. And then the Patuxent School was torn down. Is that right?
Yes, unfortunately.
In 1938.
In 1938, and Aldridge was open in 35. Okay, so Aldridge
Wyman.
Wyman. So Wyman, once the school closed down, the Patuxent School closed down, then at Wyman was
35
in 35, yeah. So most of the kids were sent out there. I think that is one thing that we want to make a topic of discussion for a story circle is that school, is a Patuxent School. We've discovered a couple of yearbooks. Ed Greer has a lot of wonderful photographs and information. And one of the things, for example, that we'd like to do is to try to have a reunion of some of the people who went to school there. Doesn't matter what year you went or whether you graduated or not. Ed Greer wants you to get together. And there's a question that everybody has, if we can find the answers. What happened to that school bell? There was a school bell at the Patuxent School. Ed Greer, again, remembers ringing it. He was a bell ringer. And that they want to know what happened to the school bell. So I wanted to throw that out there, if anybody can find out.
I
Where was it? It was on North Fair? South Fair? You want to talk about that, Henry?
It was on South Fair. South Atlantic and North Fair.
If that was the third school, right?
No, the first school. The first school built Patuxent was on the first school that children in Patuxent went to was a public school, was in Cranston. And then in 1828, they built the Rhode Island Society for the Domestic Encouragement of Agriculture and Industry, donated or sold a piece of land, 100 by 100, on the corner of North Fair and Fair Street. And there's two stone pillars standing there. One has been, somebody ran into one of the pillars and broke the top of the pillar off. But that was the first school. And then the second school was built halfway down on the south side of North Atlantic. And that, I understand, burned in 1881. And then they built the Patuxent School on South Atlantic. And of course that was abandoned in 1937 and torn down in 1938. And Lyman replaced that school.
Is there anyone here who attended the Patuxent School? Did I ask already? Yes. Oh. Who? Anyone here attended the Patuxent School?
I graduated
in 1924.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to ring the bell also? Or was it just the boys that got to do that?
Just Ed Greer. I'm curious to know how you picked the bell ringer.
I wonder.
Yeah. I know. I just know Ed Greer rang that bell for a long time. What's that?
Probably when you got in trouble, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll tell him. That's what he gets for not being here. We're talking about
it. Where the boys went in one entrance and the girls went in the other side.
Oh, they did?
Yes. We lined up and went in separate doors.
Now, what was it like when you were inside? Please. Did they sit you separate as well? Or did they mix you once you got inside the school?
We got classes, but outside we had to be brought in that way. I don't know why.
How many grades were in?
Six, I think.
Up to sixth grade?
Up to sixth grade.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Up to eighth grade.
Oh, we didn't go to eighth.
We didn't go to eighth.
We went to sixth.
And
then
what?
Aldridge.
What year did you graduate?
Aldridge.
The school, Patuxent School.
What year was it that we went to Aldridge? Must have been 35.
And what year did you say, Madeline, that you graduated? 24. And 24. So it was up to eighth grade It went to sixth grade. And then Aldridge. And was Aldridge there, Madeline? Do you remember Aldridge?
No.
Senior high? No? What high school did you go to?
What is now Lockwood.
Lockwood?
Yeah, it was Warwick.
Oh, Warwick High School.
It was called Warwick, yes.
And it's now Lockwood, so there was another high school there. Oh. And it was co-ed? So there were other schools there. I'm also, one of the other things we're doing tonight is we're trying to record this. That's why I may walk around, because I'm actually have a tape recorder on my lapel. I'm here. I'm wired up for everything. I also note here that we have an Edgewood Secretarial School that was on Armington Street. Does anybody remember the Secretarial School? Yes? Intensive course in all secretarial subjects for women. There's a Park shoe store. I guess we're getting into Cranston. Park Street School shoe store. Remington Dairy. It doesn't have an address. Does anyone remember that?
Remington Dairy was served this part, but they were more up in where I came from, around Coventry, Situate area.
Oh, okay. And then there's the owner, James Dooley, of Lakewood Bowling Alley. Lakewood Bowling Alley. There's no address here. It's James Dooley was the owner that bought an ad here. Does anyone remember the bowling alley, Lakewood? No. Green Lantern Beauty Shop in Edgewood. No one remembers that one. Mill Service Station, Norwood, Rhode Island. Could that be the Norwood neighborhood? Do you suppose it was referred to? Yeah, Norwood, Rhode Island, just the same way that they used to call it Patuxent Village, Rhode Island. And I'm noting here that they say Edgewood, Rhode Island, too. And here I see Lakewood, Rhode Island.
As long as you're sitting, use this one here. And that way you don't get rid of that buzz.
Lindsay's store was there. Lindsay's, 2180 Broad Street. Hoxie's Dairy Farm. Let's go back to Lindsay's store. Does anybody have any stories? Did anybody work there? Family members who worked there? Anybody remember nothing about Lindsay's?
Let me just make sure. Yeah, okay.
Well, in the old days, I know that there's some young kids who may be working there now, but your daughter. But Lindsay's, when was Lindsay's founded? Do you
1932.
Know? 1932.
Andrew Lindsay.
Andrew Lindsay.
He was a Scot.
He was.
And when Don and I did the, when Don D'Amato and I did the Patuxent Village history, Jack and Bill Lindsay had a wonderful picture of their father dressed in a kilt. And his father evidently was in the First World War and a veteran of the First World War. And I think the picture's in the Patuxent book right next to you. And so anyway, Jack and Bill Lindsay were absolutely wonderful. And during the blizzard of, was it 1978 we had the blizzard? I know some people were stranded, and it was a young woman that lived on South Atlantic, and she was the friends of the Lindsays. And so she told me the story that people were running into the store and so forth and actually jammed the store, and then it was queued up outside. And when Jack Lindsay saw this young lady, and he beckoned her to come in the rear of the store, and so she was able to come in the back of the store and get her grocery shopping, because she was a regular. So Lindsay's always took care of the regulars. But Jack Lindsay had some, Bill and, yeah, Jack and Bill had some wonderful stories. And Jack Lindsay told me one time, he said there was an old boat builder that had a shop behind Cameron's Pharmacy. And he had a number of fingers where had been cut off in an accident. And Jack said that, he said the old fellow was down in his boat shop, and he had a table saw running. And so someone one day asked him how he lost his fingers. Oh, he said, I just sort of ran him through the, he said, I just sort of talking and so forth, and next thing you know, he says, I just took the fingers just came off in the saw, and with the hand he had his fingers, he said, And he said, well, how did you do that? And he said, I just went like that. And of course, the saw was running, and he cut the four fingers off the other hand. Well, I don't know how true the story is. But Jack Lindsay also said he used to ride across the ferry boat. He knew the captain of the ferry that ran from the PAC to Crescent Pond. And he said they also had moonlight cruises, and he said one time he took one of his girlfriends out, and he said it was a very exciting evening and so forth. So,
does anyone else remember that
Lindsay's
ferry?
The Lindsay's full of stories, and just full of stories. And it's a great market, still is.
I asked, does anybody else remember that ferry? And there were two people. Yeah. I'd like to know a little bit more about the Asprey Boathouse. Does anybody have any stories to share about their either personal experience or?
Marta, I was going to
I had spoken to May Ashbrake years ago when she was telling me stories about her husband, Dave, who actually founded the Boatyard. And he died young, leaving May to raise Dick Ashbrake and to run his Boatyard. She was a little bit of a whippersnapper, really tough, and she ran the Boatyard, which I think was pretty avant-garde in that time. But when she was telling me stories, she talked about her husband having an affair that went from Ashbrake's to someplace. I don't know if it went to Crescent Park or where it went. I didn't know if anybody else knew of it, because Dave Ashbrake, I'm sure, was dead by the time I was a young kid hanging around him. So I don't know if anybody else would remember how far back that goes. Do you know, Henry?
I can't hear you.
The Asprey Boathouse, the ferry that went from Asprey Boathouse to across the way.
From Asprey? From the BAC? Madeline says she used to take her kids to Crescent Park on the ferry from the BAC in the 40s. But not a ferry from Asprey.
I had done some research, and what I read is that the Asprey brothers, that the only way to get to East Providence at one point was to cross the river, because they were building the bridges that the Point Street Bridge and the Washington Bridge. They were repairing them and building them, and that the Asprey brothers got this idea of trying to get the folks across, and that's how the ferry got started. That's what I had read. And it became a business. It was a commuter ferry, mostly for the factory workers. And then once the bridges got done, then it became probably just a ferry, just for fun. That's what I don't know any what years those were, but that's what I had heard the story behind the ferry at the Asprey Boathouse.
Yeah. I wonder if anybody ever canoed. My neighbor, who since has passed away several years ago on the Cranston side,
Jim McLaughlin, lived on Parkway Avenue on the Cranston side. He told me several times that he used a canoe across the river to Crescent Park. And I think that's quite a feat. I don't know, has anybody ever done that?
Not canoe. I used to go back and forth on an outboard motor.
Outboard motor, yeah. Jim would be approaching 100 now, so that was probably long
ago. Always been just as wide as it is today.
Yes, but the kids might have been a little stronger. They sit inside and watch, play video games.
Janet, do you remember McLeod's?
Yes.
Boatyard?
That was before Asper.
At that spot?
I remember the name. I was going to mention that because I think it was called McLeod's before it was
Asprey's. Yeah. And Janet, right behind the new apartments being built, there's a little low squat building.
Yeah.
And they said that was the office for McLeod's Boatyard. And evidently, when they gave the boatyard up, Dave Asprey, I think, purchased that boatyard. And then further down, there was the boatyard owned by Archie Knight. Remember,
yeah.
Archie Knight?
Yeah, I remember that.
And he was the United States Marshal. And during Prohibition, he was in charge of taking rum-running boats. And his yard was, I remember going there one time, there must have been 15 to 20 boats that had been confiscated by the United States government, and they were all sitting in Archie's Knight's boatyard.
Wow.
And so I remember one other boat. There was a boat build that my grandfather talked about, was Tillinghast. And that was over on the Cranston side, right at the foot of the, right opposite the PAC. As you come down that steep embankment by the Fort Avenue. And Tillinghast, my grandfather said that he used to keep his boat. He was a member of the Rhode Island Yacht Club, and he said he kept his boat over there, he said, old Tillinghast always did some beautiful boat work. And then there was the Crandalls that lived there. There was Lon Crandall who lived over on, North Fair Street? South Fair Street. Because he lived in the Hollyhock House.
North Fair.
North Fair. I always get them mixed up.
Eddie Cotton.
Yeah. But my grandfather used to speak about all the clammers and the fishermen, and it was always that one story that Belcher wrote, but I've heard that story many times. The woman had five children, and she went to see the barber and asked the barber when she could have her children's haircut. And the barber replied, "Well, come when the tide's out." But I mean, it was really down to earth and very folksy little village with a fish store, and so Horace Belcher did some wonderful writings, and lots of them have been found in William Hall Library. Michael's connected with quite a few of the stories, and Horace Belcher and my grandfather. Horace Belcher was a newspaper reporter for the Providence Tribune, and in the 1880s, he had written a little history of Patuxent, which he finished about 1916. And so it was Janet Hartman that is the one that recovered a good many of the Belcher papers, because Annie Totten had evidently purchased the house that Annie Totten lived in.
Annie lived in the house. It had been Sue Belcher's house previously, and everything got left behind just when Sue Belcher died.
Yeah.
And so when they took over the house, all these things were in. They found all the notebooks of Horace Belcher. I forget now how Horace Belcher was related to Sue Belcher.
Horace Belcher grew up in Lakewood.
But what was his relationship to Sue Belcher?
That was his daughter-in-law. Daughter-in-law. So Belcher did some wonderful work, and then he's the one who wrote about the black elections. And so from that, Michael Bell was able to do wonderful research. He had a lecture, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago? And really terrific lecture on the, and he expanded on the black elections. And so again, we're going to thank Annie Totten for rescuing all these papers, good many of the papers. Of course, some of them were at the library in William Hall, but Annie did and of course Janet, she recognized the importance of these papers, and Janet Hartman is the one that saves good many of them. And Belcher and my grandfather had a long correspondence, and so I have both sides of the correspondence, because my grandfather always wrote a draft letter to Belcher, and then Belcher would send him material, and so Belcher was always picking my grandfather's brains for information,
and
so one of the
tradition.
Yeah. So Belcher said, "Was it true?" He said that Ephraim Bowen had a secret staircase in the old Bowen house on Fair Street. And my grandfather said, well, he'd written that his father had purchased the Bowen house, and here it is right here, in 1872. And it had all that grand cupola on it. You might just pass that around.
I am. I want to make sure I'm not going to trip.
So my grandfather wasn't sure whether it was a secret staircase there or not, but at any rate, Belcher then wrote, he said, I guess my grandfather said, what earthly use did Bowen have with a secret staircase in the house to begin with? Unless there was something going on there, though.
Gorgeous.
But Ephraim Bowen had the dock at down in Patuxent Cove. He had his own wharf called Butler's Wharf, Bowen's Wharf. And he had a mill for spinning silk. And so silk industry was quite important in Patuxent. And in the 1820s and 30s. That's beautiful. The mulberry trees, evidently, were imported from China, and they obtained the worms, and then they grew the cultures. That's the mulberry trees.
But it's called the one around the corner.
They would spin the cocoon, and they had a special little machine that would take the cocoons, and from the single thread, they would unwind the cocoon, the threads from the cocoon, and put them on a little silk winder. And so it was quite an intricate little design. But the silk, specimens of silk were displayed at the Van Mansion House.
It doesn't look at all like that, but
it still exists.
Yes.
So there must have been quite an industry. And Bowen had this manufacturing plant for making silk, growing silk. And he also had a still. And one story is recorded about Bowen. He owned a ship called the Betsy. It was owned by five other merchants of Patuxent. And it seems that the Betsy came into Newport, and it had avoided the, during this time it was the Jeffersonian embargo, and it was about 1806 and 1806, 1810. And the ship sailed up Narragansett Bay, and it didn't declare its cargo at the custom house. And so the ship was lying in Patuxent at Bowen's Wharf. The custom officials in Providence got wind of the boat had avoided the customs, and the customs officers came down from Providence, took Bowen's boat, and they took it up to Providence, and they removed the rudder. They hung the rudder in a warehouse, and they put a big lock on it, and so they impounded the boat. Well, the Patuxent men were so outraged that secretly at night, they gathered themselves, and they went up to Providence, and they smashed the, broke open the lock on the custom house bond. They retrieved the rudder, rehung the rudder on the ship, and they had to then chop a hole through the ice in order to get the boat out of the Providence River, because the upper river was frozen. They got the boat down to Patuxent. They said they loaded with hams and some old flour, and they then proceeded down Narragansett Bay. They got as far as Plum Beach, and there's a long sandy bar that runs out there. Of course, there was no lighthouse, and the ship Betsy ran aground on the sandbar. Well, the Newport people by that time had been informed that the Betsy was en route, and they heard that the Betsy had run aground on Plum Beach. So they sent the custom officers over to take charge of the cargo. And, of course, by the time they reached Plum Beach, there wasn't one single thing left on the boat. Everything was gone. So that was kind of an interesting little story about the evasion of the Jeffersonian embargo.
Just a few minutes ago, and we started, I guess Janet started talking about the fact that she used to get on her little boat and go across the way. I noticed a lot of people nodded their heads. It seems to me that the waterway is a very important, obviously a very important part of Patuxent Village. Does anybody have any stories to share about their childhood or about anyone or any story in particular that has to do with the waterway other than Henry? And I'm sure Henry can fill in if we have any quiet time, but I'd love to hear some of your personal stories. Marge, I know you had some great stories about going out into the water when you were young.
Yeah, we always took Ed had a small boat from, all the kids in Patuxent had boats from the time they were 12 on. And they were really had pre-grown of the water, which is a little shocking when you think how much more protected children are today. But we thought nothing of going all the way to Crescent Park, just pulling the boat ashore, running up the hill and getting chowder and clam cakes, or riding the rides. We had all kinds of cotton candy. They had a McCusker's, which was a fabulous. They made caramel popcorn. And then when we were done, we rode some rides and did whatever, jumped back in the boat and head back to Patuxent. And of course, there were always fireworks every year, at least twice I want to say Memorial Day and 4th of July or something like that.
You used to have a lot of bonfires.
And bonfires.
Yeah, bonfires all along the waterfront.
Right.
Years ago.
Last September, we had, prior to this, what inspired this particular project was one called the Freedom Project, and it was something that we did with the young kids of Wyman and Edgewood Highland and Norwood Schools in Cranston. And Marge went, and we did an oral history. I actually taught them. We had a very quick lesson on how to do oral histories. But Marge was there, and that story she tells fascinated them, the idea that you were as young as 8 and you had a boat, and you would just, I mean, I was aghast because I wouldn't let my 8-year-old to get on a boat now and go across. And
I think when you were 8, you had to stay in the cove. You could grow in the cove, right? Yeah.
And I don't know if it was you or Janet that had stories about just going into Providence, taking the bus when you were young as well. It was like the life was just...
I did it, and my kids did it. I was thrilled that my kids could do a lot of the things that I did as a child. And they always took the bus to Providence. Taking the bus to Providence was wonderful to me. From the time I was very little, my mother used to take me downtown to the department stores to do the school shopping, to do the Easter outfit shopping, or at Christmas to look at all the displays of the stores, things like that. I loved riding.
And there was a trolley. I know I've seen lots of pictures that they had trolley tracks right in the center of a village. And the trolley would take you right into town, right? And go down Broad Street. Is that right?
Yes.
Right.
I remember that very well.
And you remember that?
Yes.
Do you have any stories you want to share?
Not really, but we used to be able to go to Providence, and it was 2 fares. So it was 8 cents each fare.
8 cents?
Yeah. So it would cost you 16 cents to go to Providence. And if you wanted to go, to say, to the east side of Providence, you could get a transfer for 2 cents.
Wow. I can't imagine that. And were you doing that also very young? Did you used to hop on it?
Fairly young, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have stories about the trolleys?
I've heard stories about the bay freezing and people skating on the bay.
The bay freezing and people skating. Does anyone have
driving
on it?
Wow. David Asprey's had videos of cars all parked out at Connecticut Light so they could go ice skating.
Wow.
I think nothing of driving out there.
Wow.
No, I was going to speak of swimming. Does anyone remember swimming at what we call Butts Beach? Which was, I think, at the bottom of... not Kanach. What was the other street? I'm not sure. But it was someone made a little rocks
Swedish.
That we walked
Swedish.
Out on.
It was called Swedish Beach.
Oh, I never heard that.
Yeah.
Because Swedish was on the other side of the hill.
Of Scandia Avenue.
Yeah. This would be further down. But we used to go swimming there. Amongst all of, and when I think of it now, Bayside Avenue and all those streets are, what do you call it, went right into the bay.
Yeah.
You could stand on the edge of the street, at the bottom
it would
of the street, and
go
watch
right
the
in.
Sewage come out. And we were swimming in that. When I think of it now, do you remember that, Henry?
That was going to be my next question. Was it actually that clean that you could swim in there?
No.
But you didn't care, or
but
you didn't know.
We survived.
That's true. So there's a lot of stories about the waterways. Again, you know, that'd be another story circle. We can concentrate on just the beaches. We can concentrate on boats. We can.
What about Rocky Point? You talk about going to Crescent Park. Was Rocky Point in operation then?
Yes, it was.
Just quite a bit farther from.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It wasn't
a
quick boat ride.
And it seems to me it was kind of expensive for us kids to go to Rocky
Point. So Rocky Point was more high class?
I think it was more.
Or just more expensive?
Well, more expensive. It was then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can actually see Crescent Park from...
About 3 miles to Crescent Park.
Directly across from us.
Yeah, you could go across the boat easily. And you could do... Like my father would take me, and we would just put the anchor in the sand and walk up the hill and get clam cakes. You know, it seemed like it was easy to go back and forth.
across. But to go down to Rocky Point is really further. Mm-hmm. It's really further.
Yeah, so all the way down Warwick Neck.
Were most of these boats sail, or were they rowboats?
Were they rowboats or sailboats? Who is it that
I
took boats?
This was about a 14-foot skiff with an outboard head.
Yes,
mine too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was common, I think. You know, 12, 14-foot skiff with an outboard.
Yeah.
Evan Rude, mm-hmm. Johnson.
Scott Atwater.
Oh, right.
So most of you, I guess at some point that when you're in your childhood, you got a boat for...
I didn't.
Of your own? No, it was...
I was with my father.
With your father.
If I had a boat, it was when I was really young and I went to Asprey's and I would take a leaky, abandoned rowboat and a board and paddle myself around in the cove.
Right.
Even before I knew how to swim.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't see the problem.
No, me either. Great. Now, Henry, I think there's a picture here of the armory that Henry has, and everybody knows what the armor is. And I was wondering if you could share some stories about this photograph of the armory.
Oh.
Or anyone else. I know that there's many people out here who...
I was very fortunate to make friends with Robert Hunt Rhodes. And he had a diary left to him by his grandfather, General Elisha Hunt Rhodes. And Bob Rhodes lives in Walpole, and it was a very interesting. One time I was up in Maine, and I stopped at a bookstore, and I had a big Gatsby sticker on the back of the car, and another gentleman came in, and he said, oh, he said, I noticed a Rhode Island car with a Gatsby sticker. And so I said, oh, it's my car. And I said, I'm Henry Brown. He said, I'm Bob Rhodes. And so that's how we met. And it's the strangest, here we meet hundreds of miles from Patuxent. But he had grown up in Cumberland, but his grandfather, General Elisha Hunt Rhodes, great-grandfather, evidently was born on the Warwick side, and then his father died, and he moved to the Cranston side. And so evidently General Rhodes fought in every major battle and recorded this wonderful journal. And Bob Rhodes lived in Walpole, and so he was in contact with Ken Burns, who was then assembling a film called the Civil War series. And so some of Ken Burns' friends said, he said, you should see this journal. It was kept by, and Bob Rhodes has transcribed, it belonged to his great-grandfather. And so when Burns looked at it, he said, this is very exciting. And so if you see the series on the Civil War, you can see how it's woven into the fabric of the film. Well, at any rate, in 1902, General Rhodes was a very active member of Harmony Lodge, and the Harmony Lodge met at the Armory Building there on Remington. So, in 1902. When the Harmony Lodge gave up the building, General Rhodes had three wonderful pictures taken. And Bob Rhodes, about 2 years or 3 years ago, asked me if I'd like to have the photographs. And so I accepted them. And so anyway, I've been able to share them. And Michael Bell has just taken a photograph for the collection that he's assembling on various scenes of Patuxent and so forth. So that... anyway, that's the story of this wonderful photograph that was taken by, or had General Rhodes took a photograph of. I was just saying here, Margie O'Hara has a wonderful story about, the number one enemy of Patuxent, Dinky O'Connor. And do you remember?
Now think carefully, Mike. You don't know who's in this room tonight.
That's the house down with the lions, the California ranch with the lions that are now missing. That's Dinky O'Connor. Oh dear God. That's the story of
that one was Cameron.
When
Dinky
we were teenagers. Dinky O'Connor is the modern one down That
was Cameron O'Connor.
Oh, Cameron O'Connor.
Dinky O'Connor.
I don't
was
know
off
Dinky.
Fair Street.
Yeah, Dinky was.
Dinky was off Fair Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I don't know.
Fair Street. You're right. Cameron lived
yeah.
on the
Cameron
wharf.
Was
no,
on
my
the
story
wharf.
Is Cameron, not Dinky.
Well, tell us about Cameron then.
Oh, I don't know.
Now you can't leave us hanging.
We were just teenagers, and we loved to roam the neighborhood at night. And we never did anything really bad, but we used to sneak around and peek in all the houses. We were 12 and 13, and Debbie Eberle and I, evidently he was a big mafia gentleman, as I understand, so he had a lot of friends in high places. Well, we decided we were going to spy on him. Don't know whatever possessed us. Needless to say, the next thing we knew, we were both grabbed by the cops. And that was the last of my juvenile delinquency behavior. The cops in those days didn't talk to your parents. They put you in the car, took you down, gave you, you know, big talking to. And when they were done and sure that you weren't going to get in any more trouble, they'd bring you home. Today, that would have been totally unacceptable, but that's the way it was dealt with in 1960. And Debbie Eberle went on to work for Paramount Studios in California, and I went on to be a nurse delivering babies for 30 years at Kent Hospital. And so we are all right.
Another interesting thing about the O'Connors, who lived in Patuxent, Dinky lived up on next to the Bowen House, and Cameron lived on the waterfront with the two big lions or panthers or whatever they were. And they were both known in 1930 as the number one enemies of Rhode Island. They were the syndicate crime boss of Rhode Island. And they both ran the numbers rackets, and they had a bookie parlor on Butler Court. And Butler Court is, I don't know if you know the architect Donald Conlon, but Donald Conlon lived in that house right opposite where Fred Costello lives. And it's set back, but it's a long, big, long, narrow, rectangular building. And I understand it had a bank of 50, 60 phones. And when the house was raided by the police in 1946, they found an underground cable running from the house all the way connecting to Lincoln Downs racetrack. And so they were really big time gamblers. And so Dinky O'Connor, of course, was arrested and taken to court. And it seems that the court, several times, it seems the high sheriff couldn't, one time when they were ready to recess the they were ready to bring O'Connor to trial, they couldn't find the witness. And it seems the witness had accepted a $400 bribe and left town. And so it was postponed a number of times. So then Dinky, his name was Charles O'Connor, Charles Dinky O'Connor. And he eventually was brought up, and his attorney was Colonel Patrick Quinn. And it seems that the owner of the Lincoln racetrack paid a retainer to Patrick Quinn a $20,000 retaining fee. And the trial was taking place just before Christmas. And as the attorney, prosecuting attorney, Quinn said, he said, I said, before this trial continues, he said, we should be charitable because it is now almost Christmas. And he said, I think we should dismiss and postpone this trial out of charity to Mr. O'Connor, which was done. And so Dinky was never convicted, but he said, well, I have enough money, he said, and I can buy anything. But he had a second wife. His first wife was Gertrude, and his second wife was Rosamond. And you knew the kids, didn't you? Rosamond O'Connor, children.
No, that's not me.
Did you know? You knew them.
Rosamond was the wife of Cameron.
Cameron had two wives at the same time.
Cameron. Yeah.
Which is why we were trying
to investigate. Well, one was a true marriage down on Butler Court, and then there was a common law family in Gubby Francis Farms. And that's the daughter of that woman is one that I went to school with.
Didn't they own the Compton Hotel in Narragansett?
I don't know what his holdings were. I just went to school with this girl. I don't know anything.
Hotel on Ocean Road.
Could be. I know that Cameron lived to be a fair age. I remember him as an older man. And I think that his downfall finally was that they got him on income tax evasion. But I don't believe he was ever convicted of anything else. But the money was probably distributed to grandchildren or something before that happened. You know?
I was told another story by a close friend, and he said that Dinky had told him the story. And he said in 1947, Raymond Patriota from the Hill was taking over the numbers rackets, and so made a visit to informed Dinky that he'd like to meet with him. And so Dinky said, I told my wife, he said, I'm going out, he said, with Raymond Patriota, and he said, I may not be returning. So he said, the car pulled up in front of the house, he said, I stepped into the car. He said, we had a meeting. The car pulled down on the point over Patuxent Neck. And so he said, when he returned, he said he was dropped off at home. And they said, well, what happened? And Dinky said, he said, Raymond made me an offer. I said I couldn't refuse. So O'Connors were out. But Cameron evidently did not buy into the part of this deal. And Cameron was found dead in West Warwick. He died of blood poisoning, lead poisoning, in West Warwick.
That's a bad story. I didn't do it.
But their father was Mickey the Rug. And so one of the children is named Mickey O'Connor. And Mickey, evidently, the father was carrying a rug around with dice. And he'd get a group together and so forth, and he roll out his rug, and then they shoot crap. So,
oh,
I've heard about a candy store that used to be somewhere in the Lakewood section. Does anybody remember that candy store? You do. Go ahead, Henry.
It was. Let me see, South.
Was it Flynn's?
I don't. Flynn's. Is that.
Directly opposite the fire station. You know what the town hall was? Mm-hmm. Janet? It was a little candy store run by a couple old people, old folks there.
No. Flynn's Candy Store?
Madeline. There was a. Flynn's. But it was on Atlantic Avenue, I think.
I think that's the one I remember. I read about it. I just wondered if anybody remembers that candy store. No? Or maybe it was a market shop, a market. No?
The only thing I remember in Lakewood was Lakewood Spa.
Stockard's?
Yeah.
Stockard's
was
on the North
Fair. Was that the candy store?
Well, they had penny candy there.
It was a mom and pop.
They didn't make it there. It was a little grocery store. But as a kid, we always went there to buy our penny candy.
Is that the house that looks like it?
Yeah.
That looks like
it's
it was
there.
A store.
Next door
to
my house.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Stockards, were they a well-known family? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, you had the Stockard store there, and you had Capron's up above. Capron's was up by Roosevelt Street.
There was another store on the Parkway down by Smythe Avenue.
There was one on the Parkway, too, but I don't know the name of that one.
Henry, the name of the store at the end of Narragansett Parkway?
Grant's. Lizotte's grocery store?
Oh, Lizotte's was on North Shore.
Wasn't that your relative, your uncle and aunt?
My uncle
was on. Before Stockard? Yeah. But they're trying to remember the one on Narragansett Parkway.
Didn't think I knew that.
is that, that's not the one on Narragansett Parkway, though?
No, it was
the
on,
one that, the,
it was on the North Shore Avenue. North Shore.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Lena's. Lena had the store. Yeah, I was, yeah. You remember that. Yeah. See, we're similar vintages over here.
Now, where was Lena's?
Lena's store.
Yeah, in, it was
yeah,
right over where
in the
Swedish
colony.
Condominiums are, yeah.
Yeah, in the Swedish colony.
I just know Patuxent Village, you know, where the business section is where it is now. I never realized that there were a lot of little stores right in our, in the, within the neighborhoods where the homes are now.
Can I ask a question?
Holly was just reminding me that
we
had a question about the murals at the Driftwood. All of you must remember the murals at the Driftwood.
Oh, yes.
Paintings of Patuxent Cove.
Yes.
And along the way, a man removed them, and we did a story in the Bridge trying to save them, hoping that they would be put someplace and taken care of. And Holly said, we have to find them. I said, yeah, that's good. So I asked about 100 people, and we're going to ask everybody here, does anybody know where the murals are now?
What was the family's name?
Do you remember, Holly? I found
are you talking about the Drift?
The Driftwood murals.
Doesn't he live next to her?
I found the name of the owner that took them down.
Jimmy's Driftwood.
And he lived over near you.
Didn't he move to two houses down from us?
What's his name?
Budlong?
Budlong?
His first name is Michael. I don't know his last name.
Was it Budlong?
Michael.
Michael doesn't help.
He just moved to my
we
street.
We need more than Michael.
He just moved to my street about 2 years ago. He used to live where? In like Johnston or North Providence?
Yes.
But he liked the village so much when he had the Driftwood. He said eventually he knew he was going to come back, so he just moved here. So I could probably ask him.
How old a gentleman is he?
Well, he's, you know, what do you think, 75?
Okay, Michael... It's not Bedrosian, is it?
No, you know what you're thinking about?
Oh.
Kazoyan
owned the Driftwood.
He owned it.
And the murals were there when Kazoyan owned it.
Oh, right.
But Kazoyan sold the Driftwood to, I think, this man. And if his name is Budlong or whatever it is, he's the one that took the murals down. And then it changed hands, like, two or three times before it finally became Boston. Kazoyan had it the longest, I think. Bob Kazoyan.
Yeah.
If anybody ever figures out where those murals are, let one of us know. We'd love to find them and have them on display again. I think everybody probably loved those murals when they were up.
Robert Hahn was the artist.
Robert
Hahn on the neck. He was the artist. And it was the whole cove, the pictures.
So there's two unsolved mysteries. What happened to the murals and what happened to the bell?
Yeah, that's right.
So we're gonna have...
I have another question. I remember as a kid people saying that slot machines for Las Vegas were made in Patuxent. Is that true? Do you know of any story like that? Slot machines. No. That's what I was told that when I was a kid. And I never found any information out about it. I was always curious regarding that.
Never heard that.
No?
Okay, I think it's getting a little bit late, and we normally try to finish around 8 o'clock and get back home. I want to thank everyone for coming. This really was very exciting for me, and I learned a lot. Being, as I said, a current resident, I really enjoy listening to many of your stories. I hope some of you can get back in touch with us if you're interested in hosting or in either hosting a story circle in your home or just putting one together. I'm sure that we could go to the boathouse at some point, if anybody's interested. As I said, Ed Greer is very interested in trying to get a reunion of some of the graduates or family members of graduates of the Patuxent School. and find out where that bell went.
Marta, it might be a good idea while you have several of those members here to get their particular names.
If you those index cards, if you can make a note on them that you went to that school, and what year you went, that would be helpful. Then that's a start. We can get back to you there. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank all of you for coming this evening. And if you the next one is April 1st?
Yeah.
April 1st. April Fool's Day. It's a Thursday, and Dr. Bill Simmons from Brown will be here talking about, I think, Native American history in Patuxent Village, which should be, I think, very interesting. Same room, same time, April 1st. Also, the library is sponsoring an event for Women's History Month. The flyers are on the table. That's going to be Monday, March 22nd. So I hope some of you have come to that, too.
Do you think anyone here has postcards?
I'll take a round.
Martha, have you spoken to